The headlines: Iran says the United States is responsible for the grim situation Afghanistan is facing and the suffering its people are enduring. A former U.S. official says the administration of ex-President Donald Trump tried to play down American troops' injuries in an Iranian missile attack on a U.S. base in Iraq. And France says it will not accept Britain's, quote, financial blackmail as London steps up efforts to prevent migrants crossing the channel to reach Britain. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Iran's foreign minister says the United States is responsible for the current dire situation and the suffering of the people in Afghanistan. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments in a meeting with his Qatari counterpart in Tehran. The top diplomats discussed a host of issues, including the recent developments in Afghanistan. During the meeting, Amir Abdullahian stressed the need for the formation of a broad-based government as the only way to restore stability to the war-weary nation. The official also reiterated Tehran's support of an Afghan government that includes all factions. In a later tweet, Qatari Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani highlighted the effectiveness of having a unified vision to ensure a comprehensive solution for Afghanistan. About 200 foreign nationals, including Americans, have flied out of Afghanistan in the first airlift since a U.S.-led evacuation operation ended on August the 30th. Qatar, which has helped open the airport in Kabul, said the first international commercial flight since U.S. withdrawal has departed Kabul. It said the airport has been tested and operationalized in the past few days. This comes after the Taliban's newly announced government agreed to the departure. The group's takeover of Afghanistan last month triggered the chaotic U.S.-led evacuation of 124,000 Afghans and foreigners from Kabul Airport. The facility was inactive after the operation. And the Taliban accused Washington of violating their peace deal by retaining the group's interior minister on the U.S. terror list. The group said keeping the cabinet members of the Haqqani family on the list is a clear violation of the 2020 agreement. This comes after the Pentagon said the Haqqani are still legitimate targets and remain on U.S. blacklists. The new minister is accused of involvement in attacks on U.S. forces during Washington's two-decade war in Afghanistan. In the wake of the 2020 deal with the Taliban, the United States had reportedly pledged to remove the group's members from the list of international sanctions. The deal paved the way for the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces last month. Elsewhere, a former U.S. official says the White House tried to downplay and delay reports of injuries American troops suffered in Iran's last year missile strike. The revelation was made by Alyssa Farah, an advisor to former President Donald Trump. She said Washington wanted to make the Iranian attack look unsuccessful while U.S. troops had suffered, quote, very significant injuries. In January last year, Iran fired a number of ballistic missiles at Ain al-Assad airbase hosting American soldiers. The strike was conducted in retaliation for the U.S. assassination of top Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani. The White House initially claimed there had been no casualties among his forces. However, it later conceded that over 100 soldiers had suffered traumatic brain injuries. Iran says that it will continue to allow the International Atomic Energy Agency to conduct safeguards inspections of the country's nuclear sites. A spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, however, said that Tehran will no longer permit IAEA inspections beyond the safeguards agreement. Behrouz Kamavandi described the decision as a response to the U.S. refusal to remove its anti-Iran sanctions. Late last year, Iran's parliament passed a resolution blocking foreign inspectors' unannounced access to the country's nuclear facilities. The motion followed the failure of the parties to the 2015 nuclear deal to guarantee Iran's interests under the accord. Now, Tehran warns the IAEA against disrupting talks aimed at reviving the deal, also known as the JCPOA.
The IAEA cannot dissociate itself from the destiny of the JCPOA. Any counterproductive action disrupts the negotiation process. Of course, I hope that wisdom prevails in the Board of Governors next week. Cooperation for cooperation, goodwill for goodwill, action for action.
Qasem Gharibabadi said the IAEA has a duty to be impartial, professional, and independent. He also called on the agency to seek increased cooperation among its member states instead of sowing mistrust. Earlier, the Iranian president made similar remarks. Ebrahim Raisi warned the IAEA that its, quote, unconstructive attitude towards Iran could disrupt the course of JCPOA revival talks. He noted that Tehran's cooperation with the agency proves its transparency. Raisi also said his country was the only party that honored its commitment to the 2015 nuclear deal, despite the other signatories' failure to fulfill their obligations. The JCPOA has been in disarray following Washington's unilateral withdrawal in 2018. Our correspondent, Homa Lezgi, is joining us now from Vienna. Homa, it's great to see you. Talk to us more about, first of all, Iran's comments regarding the International Atomic Energy Agency. Tehran has said that it will continue the safeguards inspections, allow the continuation of the safeguard inspections of the country's nuclear sites. But Iran also had its criticism of the IAEA as well. Tell us more, please.
Yes, Mardia, hello. As you said there, I think everything lies in the upcoming IAEA Board of Governors meeting, the decision that's going to be made there. Are the IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi's latest reports going to lead to a resolution? This is something that diplomats from the US and the three European countries, the Britain, France, and Germany, are discussing. We're hearing that on Friday, tomorrow, diplomats from these countries are expected, from the European countries, are going to meet the U.S. envoy on Iran in Paris and discuss, you know, the action that they're going to agree on to take at the IAEA Board of Governors. But Iran has made it clear, both the president and the Iranian ambassador to the IAEA here in Vienna, that if they decide to go ahead with a resolution, this will certainly impede the process of negotiations. It would endanger any revival of talks to get the JCPOA back on track. We should remember that the JCPOA, although it's not completely dead, and talks, there are still hopes that talks can revive it, in practice it does not really exist, because Iran is going ahead with its nuclear activities over and beyond its the obligations mentioned in the JCPOA, and at the same time the other parties to the deal are not living up to any of their commitments when it comes to trade cooperation with Iran, when it comes to sanctions removal, etc. So no party to that deal is actually getting any benefits from it, especially when it comes to the Islamic Republic of Iran. And that's why Iran decided, following the U.S. withdrawal and the Europeans' failure to remove sanctions or to do business with Iran, Iran decided to resume its nuclear activities and said that these activities are remedial and it can, they can be reversed once the JCPOA is again back in place. Now, this also includes the level of Iran's cooperation with the agency, because the fact that Iran was allowing the agency to have snap inspections, giving the agency short notice access, these are all fall under the additional protocol that Iran was implementing provisionally under the JCPOA. And also Iran's voluntary measures under the JCPOA included giving the IAEA further access to its site. So when the parliament in Iran decided that Iran should go over and beyond its JCPOA obligations, this also included the level of cooperation with the agency. So now any access that Iran gives to the IAEA will be based and is based on the Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement. As an IAEA member state, Iran has this, as other IAEA member states with the agency, and the agency under the safeguards agreement cannot call, for instance, on cannot call for snap inspections or short notice inspections or inspections of undeclared sites. So Iran is saying that it's following the rules as far as the comprehensive safeguards agreements goes, and as of course the nuclear non-proliferation treaty as well, but it's no longer going to you know, stick to those voluntary measures and give transparency measures and give further access to the agency when it's not at all benefiting in any way from the JCPOA, and the fate of that remains in the balance. And I'll just quickly add now that what Mr. Ghali Babadi said here is, although the agency says that its work is technical and it's completely in a separate path from the JCPOA, the reports that Mr. Grossi makes and the resolutions that are passed or the decisions that are made in the Board of Governors of the agency based on those reports do in practice affect the process of negotiations for the revival of the JCPOA.
All right, thanks a lot. Thomas Blaisky joining us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Now, elsewhere, Paris has warned London against, quote, financial blackmail as Britain steps up efforts to prevent migrants from crossing the English Channel from France. The French Interior Minister said his country will not accept the practice, which he described as a violation of international maritime law. Gerald Darmanin stressed, rather, that Britain's commitments to the issue of illegal migrants must be respected. This came after Britain announced plans to begin turning back migrants' boats before crossing into UK waters. Back in July, Britain had pledged financial assistance to help France stem the flow of illegal immigrants. However, London has reportedly said that it may withhold the money. Our Paris-based correspondent Chris Denhon says neither France nor the United Kingdom is willing to take responsibility for migrants crossing the English Channel.
The last months have been observed a record of migrants taking boats, small and medium-sized boats, from France to the UK. And the international maritime law stipulates that if these boats arrive in the territorial waters of the UK is obliged to save the human life and to keep those people in a security. Now the UK is doing everything to interpret this maritime law on another level. They say we only have to do this with big boats, and when there isn't like a big huge accident, then they have to intervene, not with small boats. So they want to send back these boats to France. Now France, the Darmanin minister, interior minister, he says that he is basing on this international maritime law, obliging the UK to keep the migrants in the UK. Now, Darmanin is not doing this with the humanitarian feelings, because he himself is a known anti-migrant and a racist minister in the past and in the present. He is doing this because France prefers not to receive these migrants back in France.
A Palestinian official warns Israel of major unrest if any of the six prisoners who escaped this week is killed during the regime's manhunt. The governor of the West Bank city of Jenin said, if the lives of the inmates are harmed, the situation will be very bad. He added that Ramallah won't cooperate with Israel to locate and capture the prisoners. Meanwhile, Israel has canceled family visits for all Palestinian inmates this month as a collective punishment following the prison break. The prisoners fled one of Israel's highest security jails on Monday through a hole reportedly dug with a spoon. The Syrian army has taken control of a strategic area in the southwestern city of Dara under a Russian-brokered ceasefire deal with the militants there. Under the terms of the deal, militants must either leave the area or hand over their firearms if they choose to remain. Earlier, Muhammad Ali joined us with more details.
Yes, I am now inside the Daraa governorate in southern Syria. I am exactly standing at the entrance of Daraa al-Balad, the area that the Syrian army entered and took control of just 2 days ago following a deal reached with the armed groups inside this quarter. Now, there are thousands of people, civilians, residents, who left Daraa al-Balad about 2 weeks ago when the negotiations failed. They were fearing of the battles that could have could happen inside. So those civilians left 2 weeks ago, and the Syrian government welcomed them in temporary shelters until this deal is reached. Now that the deal is reached, now that security is restored inside and that the armed men have surrendered their weapons and they have reconciled with the Syrian government, the civilians now are going back home. The recent developments with regards to this deal is that the Syrian army has established several security checkpoints to ensure security and stability in the future inside Daraa al-Balad.
Yemen's health officials say at least 100 health facilities have stopped offering services due to fuel shortage. They blame the shortage on Saudi Arabia, saying the kingdom's imposed siege on the impoverished nation has hampered daily life in Yemen. Abdullatif Al-Washali has more in this report.
The healthcare system in Yemen is deteriorating due to the ongoing Saudi blockade that has led to a harsh shortage of fuel. Sana Health Bureau said 100 health facilities had to stop providing health services partially or completely due to their inability to generate power anymore.
The fuel cuts in our country due to the blockade and aggression have affected the ability of health facilities to provide the necessary health services to our people. Our hospital has been negatively affected so that we have no way but to increase the charge of our services, and this constitutes an additional burden on Yemenis, especially amid the war and siege.
A civilian maternal hospital in Yemen's capital Sana'a used to have 45,000 liters of diesel each month as a grant from the World Health Organization. However, the world body, the hospital said, has stopped its fuel grant due to what it says, financial problems.
We are Sabine Hospital in Sana'a. It is the referral hospital for maternity and the childhood disease. We are before we received oil from the WHO during 2021. The amount of the oil received to the hospital is become decreased to the fourth. The amount already we receive it. It is big catastrophe. It will lead to the death of the many. Child and woman, especially that admitted in the ICU, in the nursery, and the OT. Here in the hospital, we decrease most of our services to decrease the use of the electricity.
Earlier, Yemen's petroleum company said only three oil ships were allowed to arrive at Hudaydah port since the beginning of 2021, covering only 3% of what is required to fulfill the basic needs of Yemenis. The Saudi war and the blockade have led Yemen to the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations.
Yemen's healthcare system is on the verge of collapse as a result of the Islamic Saudi war and the blockade. Yemenis also blame the United Nations for their suffering, saying the world body should take real measures against the continuous Saudi violations of their rights. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
in the limelight. The Taliban have announced an all-male caretaker government, including an interior minister wanted by the FBI, on a day when at least two people were killed by violent policing of street protests against the new authorities in Afghanistan. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Emma Graham Harrison and Akhtar Mohammad Makoui. The piece is titled, Taliban Name All-Male Afghan Cabinet, Including Minister Wanted by FBI. Stay with us for more. The Taliban have announced an all-male caretaker government, including an interior minister wanted by the FBI, on a day when at least two people were killed by violent policing of street protests against the new authorities in Afghanistan. The leadership, unveiled on Tuesday, 7th of September, is drawn entirely from Taliban ranks. Despite promises of an inclusive cabinet and many of its senior figures are on United Nations sanctions list, which is likely to complicate the group's search for international recognition. Late on Tuesday, 7th of September, a U.S. State Department spokesman said, "We note the announced list of names consists exclusively of individuals who are members of the Taliban or their close associates and no women. We also are concerned by the affiliations and track records of some of the individuals. We understand that the Taliban has presented this as a caretaker cabinet. However, we will judge the Taliban by its actions and not by its words." The U.S. State Department renewed its call on the Taliban to offer safe passage to U.S. citizens as well as to Afghan citizens looking to leave the country. Afghanistan will once more be officially known as an Islamic Emirate, as it was under Taliban rule in the 1990s. The Prime Minister will be Mullah Muhammad Hassan Akhund, one of the founding members of the group, who was close to its original leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar. He has had far less international exposure than other senior Taliban leaders, but as head of the group's powerful leadership council, he is one of its most influential members. Mullah Muhammad Omar's son, Mullah Yaqub, will be defense minister in the new caretaker government, and the acting interior minister is Sirajuddin Haqqani, who is on the FBI wanted list. In his first statement since the Taliban seized power last month, Mullah Muhammad Hassan Akhund said Afghanistan's new rulers were committed to all international laws, treaties and commitments not in conflict with Islamic law. In the future, all matters of governance and life in Afghanistan will be regulated by laws of Holy Sharia, he said. The Taliban face a major economic crisis, domestic pressure from political opponents, and an uprising in Panjshir Valley that has not been entirely stamped out despite their capture of the provincial capital in Panjshir. International pressures were highlighted by protests in Kabul that drew hundreds of people and which, although initially peaceful, ended in the Taliban firing guns into the air, beating protesters and journalists, seizing equipment, and detaining some people. A smaller protest in the western city of Herat ended with two dead and at least four injured, according to the Afghan newspaper Ittala-e Rooz. The Guardian saw video of Taliban dispersing protesters with gunfire. With domestic reserves frozen and the country long dependent on international aid, there is also a desperate search for international legitimacy that may allow funds to keep flowing into Afghanistan. The government lineup is unlikely to offer progress on any of those fronts. Instead, it appears primarily designed to prevent internal fractures within the Taliban movement, after weeks of heated internal discussions about power sharing, said Harun Rahimi, a law professor at the American University of Afghanistan. It won't help with domestic legitimacy. It won't help with international recognition. It will not help ease the resistance, and it will not help government run more smoothly, he said, pointing out that few ministers had expertise in their portfolios. So I have to conclude that the only reason they chose this kind of makeup was to make sure there will be no internal fractures. The new cabinet is also heavily dominated by the Pashtun ethnic group that formed the Taliban's original power base, but which makes up only about 40% of Afghanistan's population. Just three appointees in the new caretaker government appear to be from other ethnic groups. It was unveiled by the government spokesman, Zabihullah Mujahid. Asked about the lack of inclusivity, Mujahid could offer only vague promises that the minor portfolios outstanding may be awarded in a way that broadens the government. Some ministers and deputies and many top positions are remaining. We will try to include people from across the country into it. It's not a permanent cabinet, and we will try to make it more inclusive, Zabihullah Mujahid said. Another sign that Taliban promises of change, including respect for media freedom, were being tested by the reality of governing. Zabihullah Mujahid said people should not be protesting at this time because the country had recently emerged from a crisis. He also suggested that some protesters were incited from abroad, a possible reaction to the fact that many of those on the streets were attacking the Taliban as an instrument of the Pakistani government. For two decades, Pakistan provided the Taliban with safe haven, and the head of its influential Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, or ISI, spent 3 days in Kabul this week as negotiations about the new government were hammered out. But the Taliban and Islamabad deny any significant ties. There were no immediate response to the new government from the countries that have bankrolled Afghanistan's aid in the past, and now face the prospect of engaging with a leadership dominated by figures who are on United Nations sanctions lists. There is pressure for the international community to work with the Taliban to try to stave off disaster for the most vulnerable of the country's 38 million inhabitants. The United Nations has warned that access to food aid and other life-saving services is close to running out, as concerns mount that the country is facing a looming humanitarian catastrophe. The grim assessment from the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs came amid an appeal for an extra $200 million in emergency funding in Afghanistan after the Taliban's takeover sparked a host of new problems. The United Nations says 18 million Afghans are facing a humanitarian disaster, and a further 18 million people could quickly join them.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Gunrunners, directed by Canadian documentary filmmaker Anjali Nayar. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Tete Coffey, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Gunrunners, which is shot over a 10-year period, follows two Kenyan cattle rustlers, who are also known as warriors, Julius Urile and Robert Mutanda, who put their violent past behind them to become marathon runners as part of a government-sponsored program to disarm the conflict-heavy region. We see Urile enter international marathons, while Mutanda gets involved in the political sphere and dreams of working towards policy change. Though as we see these once notorious warriors given a chance to pursue their dreams, we realize that the road to glory is full of bumps and detours for these charismatic men. Well, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Kenya is known as a destination for world-class marathon runners, but it's not as glamorous as it seems to be a top athlete in that part of the world, particularly because some of them are quite literally running for their lives, running away from crime, and we see that cattle stealing, or cattle wrestling, as it's called, is quite commonplace because that's an important source of income, and this region is also engulfed in the illegal arms trade industry, which is part of a global multi-billion dollar industry. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, firstly, it's just a fascinating sort of insight into, you know, a situation that I really did not know much about. You know, I know very well that Kenya is a history of producing great runners. I didn't know about this, you know, pretty fantastic government-run program, this sort of amnesty and the disarmament idea, which is a really great one, and obviously it gives a great film title then, Gunrunners. The film itself, I mean, I think it was shot over 10 years, so I, you know, you can only imagine how much footage has been accumulated during that time. And I guess, as fascinating as I found the subject and the two principal characters, I felt that in a sort of 90-minute running time, you're kind of skipping big chunks. You know, so much is going on, and I didn't feel that I was getting to know the two men in the way that I would have liked. I mean, basically, I could imagine a longer film that would I would have maybe, you know, it's longer, but you would have felt more in getting into the rhythm of what's going on with these people, because there's so much to say, and they go through so many changes, both of them individually, and I feel 90 minutes doesn't necessarily do justice to everything that's, you know, it's trying to encapsulate.
You're right, it is absolutely jam-packed. It touches on issues of violence, as well as the main themes of sports and running, but then also politics and corruption. There's just so much in this documentary. And Tete, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Gunrunners?
Okay, normally when I'm told about documentaries about Africa, I yawn, roll my eyes and go, oh God, not again. I tend to want to avoid them. I was very pleasantly surprised by this for two reasons. One, it was rich in context, so that whatever was going through the lives of these two, the protagonists, if you like, it was placed within context and it gave you an understanding of the environment from which they came. Secondly, I think it was done with quite a lot of sensitivity. There's little tricks he used in what you call chopping and changing. I mean, cutting from the Rift Valley, training scenes in
which is absolutely breathtaking.
Exquisite. In Kenya, over to the skyscrapers of New York, you could see that these are two little people operating in one world, but kind of moving out into a much, much bigger world. And the third thing I really liked about it was that it looks as if these two characters are archetypes, and Arili is very much the superstar, the very talented runner and so on. And his mate, Matanda, seems to be much more the political type. So how the two characters fare was something I was always watching to see. I was impressed.
I'd like to pick apart their characters a bit later on.
Sure.
Maliv, I'd like to ask you, this documentary kind of describes itself as the American dream, but Kenyan style. It's an interesting analogy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm always a bit puzzled by this American dream. I don't understand why, you know, one country has a monopoly on wanting to change your life for the better and improve your situation. I mean, it's a cute tagline. I think it's kind of irrelevant. The fact is, yes, they do go to New York and, you know, run marathons there. But, you know, marathon running is a world global pursuit. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to me, it smacks more of marketing than any sort of reality. Why can't it be a Kenyan dream?
This Saturday marks the first annual Tekla Lorupe Peace Race. Tekla Lorupe, the former marathon world record holder from the conflict region, is partnering with the government to invite cattle rustlers to trade in their weapons in exchange for amnesty and a chance to win cows and cash prizes.
We learn from this film that this amnesty program is quite inspirational. How does it transform the lives of Arili and Matanda, Lee?
Well, I mean, you know, until this program comes in, they are very aware that they're living a very precarious, you know, highly dangerous existence, and one that they're very clearly both uncomfortable with. You know, it does involve, they don't answer it directly, but you very much get the sense that they've been involved in deaths. And obviously they've had loved ones or friends die as well. So it's just a really unpleasant, you know, precarious existence. So this government program is really trying to give people a kind of a firmer foothold in, I guess, you know, quote unquote, the right direction. So taking them away from sort of illegal activities, illegal guns, and trying to sort of, you know, push their energies and their sort of, their outlook in a more kind of positive and, you know, peaceful direction. So that's a great thing.
And Tete, the film sheds a positive light on this amnesty program. How effective is it really, and can you talk more a bit about this?
Well, there are a couple of things which come out. For a program to work, you've got to be able to transfer skills which are being adversely used or not constructively used into something which is positive. And in the way the story pans out with these two characters, Matanda is very much the organizer. I mean, he had 500 effectively gangsters, hoodlums, they call themselves rustlers, under his charge. And this guy's a people organizer. Of course, he's the one whose skills are now deployed in the political arena, actually getting people involved with the program, even campaigning for a parliamentary candidate. And he says he himself has parliamentary aspirations. Then Arili, on the other hand, is the rising star, the hugely talented individual. They said that even as a kid, he was winning things at kind of at the local level. So his skills, his competitive drive, is now being, you know, applied in an arena which can actually make him money, improve the quality of his personal life, the life of his family, and so on. And it does say that a lot depends on the quality of government, the environment you provide. These talents are available in bad neighborhoods, and they're available in the right postcodes. The difference is that in the right postcode or a stable environment, those talents are able to flourish because they are positively deployed. So in terms of this gun amnesty, Kenya had a problem. I think it was a blindingly inspired idea. It's one of the funniest quotes I actually picked up from this was, he said, well, the skills I need to run I need to be able to run fast to chase cattle, and I need to be run fast to escape the police. And he's doing that in a marathon.
That's exactly the point of this film, is that violence goes hand in hand
exactly.
with the ability to be good athletes. Yeah. And Lee, if I could ask you, an issue that is raised in this documentary is that when you have a gun, you have a sense of power. So it seems as if it's an accepted reality or part of life in Kenya.
There's an amazing quote, and to be honest, it's the thing that probably stayed with me most from this film. I think it's Mutanda who's talking. He's like, you know, if you haven't killed someone, if you haven't stolen their property, then what kind of a warrior are you? And to me, this is really then what they're actually really trying to do underline is change the whole paradigm of what makes a warrior or actually a man. And actually, that's something that is a huge, that's not just particular to this country. It's something we probably all need to look at in, you know, different societies, the way we construct masculine identity. And it shouldn't be about trying to dominate and power and, you know, impose yourself. And I think actually they don't explore that anymore, sadly, I felt in this. Mm. But the fact that he vocalizes it shows that actually it's making him reconsider what, you know, as a warrior he should be doing. And then the fact that he goes into more sort of, you know, political and sort of socially constructive things is obviously helping that situation.
When I was in the bush, I used to run. That's why when I came here, I didn't find the difficult when I started to run. Because I was running even 100 kilometers. You know, when the police is chasing you, also you chase the cattle. So you chase very fast. But if you chase very slowly, the police will capture you. And then you'll be in a hot soup.
I found both characters to be quite endearing, but I think Mutanda was the more charismatic one out of the two. And we get the sense that he had a much darker past than Arile. There was a moment when he was asked how many people he's killed, and he just looks off camera and remains silent, which is quite chilling to watch. Lee, what did you make of Matanda's character compared to Arile's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of the film is that they are very different. So you have that immediate contrast. And Tete's, you know, described it very well. Mutanda's the sort of more social, you know, political animal. He has a natural ability and affinity to kind of, you know, draw people in. Arile is much more kind of, you know, quieter, more sort of focused on his own sort of goals. And so that, I think, is one of the main strengths of the film, because as you follow their paths, you find that actually they diverge more than you might expect, because actually they aren't equally talented runners. So then one storyline really pursues the actual running side of it, and the other goes, I would say, into equally or maybe more interesting avenues about, well, if you can't do that, it's not just, you know, guns or running. Actually, if the running is not going to be your career, you can use your skills in different ways. And I think that's a very interesting.
And we see Mutanda pursue politics, but then of course we learned that it seems to be a corrupt world, and it's almost he embraces it and talks about it openly. Tete, is this a reality of life in Kenya?
It's a reality of life in Kenya, and not just Kenya, a lot of African countries. It's also the reality of life over here, but it's because there's a lot more wealth, and because ordinary people's needs are taken care of on a day-to-day basis, you don't see it as starkly. But in Kenya, it's very clear. I mean, he threatens the politician that if you don't make me, you know, minister in charge of security, which he patently won't be able to hold, he wouldn't be able to hold that position. He said he'd mobilize things against him. But what it says to me is that these individual talents are kind of drawn into this prism of organization, be it the sport, be it politics, be it whatever. And it is the quality of the organization that can absolutely, you know, enable them or absolutely destroy them.
And I want to touch quickly on the point about guns. We find out in this documentary also that there's 500,000 illegal guns in Kenya. I mean, where are they coming from and why are they there?
Well, I mean, there was a breakup of the Soviet Union, and that led to a huge kind of splurge of small arms all over the world. And, of course, these things are what are required to create kind of little lordships in all of these different countries. And it is one of the saddest statistics of African life that is that where there are the greatest resources, you have the greatest conflict. So a country like the Congo, which is incredibly wealthy, has had internecine strife for near on 40 years consecutively. Of course, while that happens, the natives can't benefit from the resources in their land, but other agents do. And unfortunately, it is often foreign agents who enable these weapons to get into the hands of these people, and so that it's almost a system of divide and rule. But of course, you know, if you're a politician in Africa and you're accepting bribes from foreign agents to create conflict and strife in your own country, that's a decision only you can make. Nobody holds a gun to your head to do that. So it comes to issues around personal integrity and so on and so forth.
That's a really interesting point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on just for the time being.
Dream about my future. Mostly I dream about money. I will build this, I will build that, many things like that.
My name is Julius Arile from Kenya. 6 years ago, being a warrior, fighting with another people from our country. But this time now, I am an athlete and I can run a marathon.
He really does need to make a breakthrough. And if he doesn't have it, then it's going to be harder to fulfill this kind of dream of being in New York as an elite, top elite athlete that could maybe make it in the top five.
Good morning and welcome to Prague, Czech Republic, for the 19th running of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon.
A great race starting in Prague's Old Town Square in this historic city.
He really is very much the underdog character in this documentary, and you really find yourself rooting for him. He has a lot of pressure on himself to prove himself, and he dreams of being on the wall, as he says, of all the top runners of Kenya. And we see him come seventh place in the first race, but then do really well in the second opportunity he has. What did you make of this sort of triumphant arc he had?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess when you're choosing your characters to focus on at the beginning of a journey, you have no idea, actually, are they going to make it? So I think it's less, it sounds a cliche, but it's less about the destination than the journey. It's fascinating to follow this particular man on his sort of athletics career. Now, if he, you know, ends up winning a gold medal at the Olympics, even more extraordinary. But actually, I find it more interesting when you see the real struggles and the person who isn't necessarily going to be the ultimate victor in this. The film really made me think about an American documentary called Hoop Dreams from the 1990s, which followed two young inner-city kids who wanted to be basketball stars. Now, neither of them end up making it, but what you get is a fascinating portrait of their environment and the world that they're in and the politics and the social disadvantages, and actually, that's a more illuminating and, I think, more fascinating storyline than just, you know, the underdog who comes from nowhere to, you know, in the last minute, you know, storms to the front and wins the medal. That's interesting, but I'm more interested in the sort of the world that shapes their, you know.
Of course, he's plagued by poverty and injuries and not the same opportunities. Tete, I see you agreeing with Lee there?
Yeah, but absolutely, the journey's fascinating. And none of these characters are pristine. Arile got somebody pregnant when she was quite young. It led to her suicide and led to him becoming a warrior. But later on, he's now got three wives and children by all of them. So if he's not able to take that, put each one of his problems in some kind of compartment, he won't be able to pursue his dream. So these dreams are always fraught. And actually, the story, as you say very well, is the compromises, you know, the calls that each person has to make to pursue what it is that they're really after, and an illumination of the environment within which all of this is going on.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk now about the parallels we see between Kenya and the US, sort of the Western world. Lee, what did you make of their journey, of Arile's journey to New York, and sort of the observations and comments he was making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very much sort of fish out of water stuff, right? So, you know, where they've grown up, where they live, what they're used to is obviously a world away from, you know, the slightly more glamorous, the more professional, the more kind of money at stake world that they go into. But I think, again, what's really interesting is in their own world as well, you see the way that they're not quite fitting in and the problems that they have. And to be honest, I would have liked the film to touch more on that. Like Tete says, they have these very checkered family lives. That's not really grappled with in the way that I would have, you know, appreciated a bit more. And I feel that, you know, of course the thread is the running and the marathon and what happens, but actually to get to know them even a bit more as characters and get a sort of a more rounded portrait of them, I would have liked to hear more about those sort of difficulties with the families and the wives and the kids, because it obviously has an impact. He wants to earn money so he can go back and provide for them, but we don't necessarily get, you know, the full story about what that entails.
And Teddy, isn't it quite sad, though, that this notion of success, we see Arile move to sort of a shack-like accommodation, and he thinks he's living in a European city. Why is that this connection of success is linked to Europe and the West?
Well, success is always relative to what you've got. I mean, this guy wasn't having three baths a week out in the bush, and he's suddenly in a shack with running water. I mean, that's luxury. He might as well, from his point of view, be at the Ritz Hotel. It's absolutely relative. But what I think it's important for people to also think about is the fact that this can be quite corrupting. This kind of drive to live in that star-spangled environment can be quite corrupting, because we all know that the industry that he's now becoming a part of, the elite athletics industry, is also incredibly corrupt.
Which is mainly dominated, sort of, as we see, by Western physiotherapists and management types.
Sure. It's incredibly corrupt. So it's really a story about how, you know, man has to try and make it, making moral judgments at every turn of the way in a not-so-easy world.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.